Today on Annenberg Radio News.
You see a lot of interesting things, and you see a lot of beautiful things, and you see a lot of heartbreaking things out here, you know.
We find out what it's like to drive a public bus through Los Angeles. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, April 10th, 2014. I'm Bryony Ng. The former assistant city manager from the city of Bell is headed to prison. Angela Spaccia was sentenced to 11 years and 8 months behind bars today. Spaccia had been making more than $500,000 per year when the Los Angeles Times broke the story of corruption in Bell in 2010. Her boss, Robert Riso, was taking home millions from the small town's public funds. Spaccia and Riso are considered the leaders among the 8 city officials who have been arrested in the Bell corruption case. In court today, Judge Kathleen Kennedy said Riso and Spaccia were only thinking of themselves.
It's all about the money, and it was all about greed. And ultimately, what happened is that both Riso and Spaccia were not content with being pigs. They were hogs, and they basically got slaughtered.
Spaccia is the first of the Bell officials to be sentenced. Yesterday, 5 other officials agreed to a plea deal with prosecutors. Riso will be sentenced next week. He faces 10 to 12 years in prison. We sent our Logan Healy to Bell today to see how residents feel about the end of the 4-year corruption scandal in their city. Mayor Eric Garcetti will give his first State of the City address tonight. Ella Bernal reports on what Angelenos are hoping to hear.
Mayor Garcetti will deliver his State of the City address this evening at the California Science Center in Exposition Park. I went out there to watch the setup and ask what Angelenos want to hear from the mayor.
Just an update with what's going on, what he's been up to since he's been in office. It's his first one, right? So he's probably got a lot to report on.
I'm hoping to hear that we can start digging ourselves out of this hole, attract more business, and continue with city services.
That he would take care of the people of L.A. in all the ways that he knows should be taken care of. Should.
Just curious to see what he has to say.
Mayor Garcetti has only been in office since last summer, so he's still in a honeymoon period with voters. But he is facing some serious problems. His speech comes one day after the LA 2020 Commission report came out. The report declared Los Angeles as a city stumbling into decline and listed several recommendations for improvement. Daily News reporter Rick Orlov says the mayor has a lot to prove.
At this point, no one is quite sure exactly what his agenda will be and what he hopes to do in his 4 years as mayor.
While Orlov is reserving judgment, journalist Jack Humphreyville sees the mayor as a welcome change.
He's done some good stuff. It's, you know, sort of the opposite of Vera Gosu, who'd go to the opening of a door.
In terms of image, Mayor Garcetti is getting good marks from Cal State professor Rafe Sonnenschein.
It's probably hard to imagine somebody who seems more in tune with the kind of contemporary Los Angeles, both his multi-ethnic and multi-religious identities, his youth, his going out to interesting events, his creativity.
If you can't make it to the mayor's address, you can live stream the speech from lamayor.org or lacityview.org. Ella Bernal, Annenberg Radio News.
And now Logan Healy brings us the reactions from the Bell case.
I parked my car at the Bell City Hall. The Bell corruption trial has received national media attention, but it's quiet here today. Right next door is the police station, where kids from a school group are getting a tour and taking turns sitting inside of a cop car. I asked their parents if they've been keeping up with the trial. They said no, and they didn't want to be interviewed. That was a common theme for my morning in Bell. Most of the few dozen people I approached didn't want to talk. Eventually, I found Miguel waiting at a crosswalk to push his baby's stroller across the street. He didn't want to give me his last name, but he told me what he thinks about the plea agreement the former mayor and city council members agreed to that cut their maximum jail time in half.
Just because they have money or they were something big in Bell, it's not fair for them to do half a term.
Samuel Carrarte was on his way to apply for a temp job. He thinks the former city officials are getting off too easy.
A friend of mine just got caught doing fraud, and he's doing a decade for $50,000. I just don't think that 4 years is fair.
Bell is one of the poorest cities in Los Angeles County. Many of the shops are closed and barred up. It was hard to find people in restaurants or markets, let alone people willing to talk to a reporter. So I decided to check out the local Starbucks. Doreen French was there. Her dad was actually the mayor of Bell back in 1954, and she said her dad was fighting City Hall corruption back then too. I told her that many of the people I had approached this morning said they weren't following the trial anymore.
Well, some of them don't want to follow it because they already know what the corruption is. And it's just a vicious circle. Around and around they go. Where they stop, nobody knows. It's like the Wheel of Fortune here.
She has strong opinions on the convicted officials.
I hope they go to hell. Rotten hell, no.
Across the street at Boulevard Burger, Isaac Pedroja shared his sentiment.
They should just get the max on everybody for messing with the people's money. Because it's hard to make money these days, you know. They should have gave them all the max.
Anytime you're living in $2 or $3 million home and living in Huntington Beach and have properties everywhere, that guy should do time.
That's Raul Alberto Alegre talking about former Mayor Oscar Hernandez. As he waited for his carryout from the Guadalajara Inn, he told me he thinks 4 years is enough for the city councilmen. He believes they were just doing what they were told. He admitted one of the convicted councilmen was an acquaintance of his.
And he seemed like a good person. I think he just got mixed up in the wrong crowd.
Just how long the convicted mayor and city council members will be behind bars will be up to a judge. Their sentencings are scheduled for this summer. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
Spirit Airlines is flying high. High on the airline complaint list, that is. According to a study by the CalPRIG Education Fund, Spirit is number one for complaints per 100,000 passengers. CalPRIG's Morgan Culbertson explains why her organization conducted the study.
The consolidation of airlines, the recent new security measures, and the rising cost of gasoline have caused Airways to cut corners. And, you know, the people that actually lose in that situation are people like you and I, consumers.
Spirit Airlines is well known for its pesky fees, like charging up to $100 for a carry-on and $10 for printing a boarding pass at the airport. The airline with the lowest rate of complaints, Southwest. This might be because Southwest offers customers credit when someone changes or cancels a flight, while Delta and American charge $200. The LA Plaza Museum opened an exhibit today called Viva la Causa. In honor of civil rights activist Dolores Huerta, the exhibit honors the role Huerta played in the fight for the rights of migrant farm workers. As Lenza Bogala reports, the opening was a perfect birthday present for Huerta.
Relatives and supporters gathered to celebrate Dolores Huerta's 84th birthday at the La Plaza Museum, located in downtown Los Angeles. The museum had its grand opening of the Viva la Causa exhibit, which will run until July 7th. It honors Huerta's lifelong activism. Huerta co-founded the National Farm Workers Association with her longtime partner, Cesar Chavez, to fight for the fair treatment of farm workers. The exhibit takes an artistic approach and documents significant moments during this movement, as well as her personal life. Huerta walked the crowd through each photograph, many of which brought back memories of the struggle of being an activist.
Once we won the boycott, the growers couldn't sell the grapes unless they had the union label.
But also some fond moments from her life.
And I was a majorette. I was one of the first Latina majorettes in California, I think. Yeah.
Huerta has 11 children. Lori De Leon, Huerta's second eldest, says that they all helped lead the movement, even though it wasn't always easy.
We suffered a lot of very scary moments in our lives, you know, growing up. So was it all worth it? I mean, that's still a question that, you know, I ask myself. The movement is bigger than just one individual.
Muralist Barbara Carrasco agrees. She says it is fitting that Huerta's sacrifices are being recognized through art.
Dolores said this in a public meeting at UCLA, that artists affirm the movement, you know, just with their various images. So to me, hearing her say that was really a nice way of thanking all the artists, because you rarely hear anyone acknowledge the artist to begin with.
photojournalist and longtime friend of Huerta, George Rodriguez, has been taking pictures of the farm workers' movement since 1969. He took several of the photographs displayed in the exhibit.
Nobody like her, you know. Dolores is like our Rosa Parks. And being around her, you know there's something special going on.
Huerta's activism and influence hasn't ended. At 84, she is still working tirelessly to bring justice to the underserved.
Happy birthday!
Lenza Bogala, Annenberg Radio News.
Tonight, expect lows around the mid-50s, and tomorrow there'll be a bit of fog in the morning, but it should clear throughout the day, with temperatures in the mid-70s. And as for Saturday, expect highs in the mid-60s and lows around 55. Later on Annenberg Radio News, find out how investigative reporting saves babies' lives. Now we continue our series looking at the people who make Los Angeles run, the night shift workers, the minimum wage employees, and the undocumented laborers. For the sixth story in the series, Rosalie Murphy takes us on a ride around Los Angeles with Joshua Salazar, a bus driver. People in Los Angeles boarded Metro buses 29 million times last month. For most, the bus is just a mode of transportation. For Salazar, it's much more than that.
How you doing? Even when I was a kid, when I would ride with my dad, I had always had it in the back of my head. And I hate to sound like a jerk, but only poor people ride the bus because they can't afford a car, or only the you know these immigrants that don't have their papers yet.
Joshua's dad started driving buses before he was born and kept driving until he died in 2008. He worked long hours when Joshua was a kid, so he didn't get to see his dad much. Most of his memories with his dad happened, well, on the bus.
I have to say my all-time favorite line is the 30 line that works Pico. And that was my dad's line. My dad always worked that line.
For me, there was a smell in the air that I can't explain. You got the hot dog lady standing on every other corner. You got the pupusa lady hanging out on this corner making pupusas. You can ask any of my dad's friends that still work here, you know, what was Turtle's line? The 30.
Your dad was also called Turtle?
Yeah, they called him Turtle. I sort of just inherited the name. When I came in, everybody called me Baby Turtle. In fact, they tell me at 5 years, they'll call me Little Turtle.
Joshua never expected that he would drive buses too, but 2 years after his dad died, Joshua stopped by his old division. One of their old family friends asked if he'd ever thought about applying at Metro. He mulled over for a few weeks and then started work in 2011. At the beginning, driving could be pretty scary.
You can't help but see the violence happen on the street sometimes, you know. When you work at night, it's a whole nother world, and I still get scared sometimes because you pick up these really crazy people that you don't really know what's going on in their heads. And for all I know, the guy could have a gun in his bag or a knife. If you think about it too much, it really starts to get to you. One of my mentors taught me how to read the walls.
Gang graffiti right there, you see that?
It's a thick, continuous line of black spray paint spelling out 18THHOOV on the side of an empty brick building bordered by barbed wire. It's only 8 p.m., and this corner is totally deserted.
See, look, this is 18th Street Hoover's.
Stop request. Please use rear exit. For your safety, please watch your step when exiting the bus.
Joshua's childhood observation that only poor people take the bus is still pretty accurate. The average passenger earns just $14,000 a year. Poverty is reality on the bus, which means Joshua, a man with a job, looks pretty good to some women.
So I sprayed myself with some Axe spray, and this girl was all, you know, the Axe commercials, you know, and the guy sprays himself and the girls are all over him. It was just like that, except it was one girl. And, you know, I kind of had to put her down gently and be like, hey, you know what, I'm in a relationship. You got the whole world ahead of you. What do you want to hit on a bus driver? And most of the time they hit on you because, you know, you got a job.
And sometimes it's just sad.
There's this guy, I think he told me his first name is Kenneth. The guy's getting on the bus with his walker, and these two young guys are telling, hurry up, motherfucker. it's raining out here, and these guys just straight pushed him out of the way. It's moments like that that make me wish that I could get up and do something.
But sometimes he can do something. Once at Christmas, Joshua helped a girl with twins and overloaded shopping bags get onto the bus. Life was clearly a struggle for her, so when she got off, he slipped her a 20 and wished her good luck.
So 2 years pass, and this young black chick gets on the bus, and she goes, "Hey, I know you." Turns out, that was the girl that my girlfriend and I helped out on the corner of 6th and Broadway getting on the 53 line.
Since then, she'd moved into a women's shelter, enrolled at LA Trade Tech, and joined LAPD. She's supporting her daughters on her own.
I never expected it to be so exciting one minute and then so tragic the other, you know? You see a lot of interesting things, and you see a lot of beautiful things, and you see a lot of heartbreaking things out here, you know?
Joshua is only 28, and at this rate, he'll be able to retire with a pension before he turns 50. But he expects to keep driving for a long time.
I really feel like this is what I was supposed to do. You know, you don't think you really make a difference sometimes, but you really do.
Rosalie Murphy, Annenberg Radio News.
Listen up, Nation. Today, CBS announced that Stephen Colbert will be taking over David Letterman's late-night talk show spot when Letterman steps down next year. Sarah Zahedi has the reaction to entertainment turnover.
Many know Stephen Colbert for his satiric persona on his Comedy Central show, The Colbert Report.
How do I define American? I look in the mirror.
The news that Colbert would take over Letterman's hosting spot came after Letterman announced his retirement last week.
I just want to reiterate my thanks and for the support from the network, all of the people who have worked here, all of the people in the theater, all the people on the staff, everybody at home. Thank you very much.
Several fans of The Colbert Report are happy to see him make the move to late night television.
Colbert is very, very funny and young and appealing to kind of the younger audiences.
I think Stephen will be a good replacement. I mean, he already has a really successful talk show, and he's really energetic and has a lot of good things to say.
But others say they hoped Letterman's replacement would be a woman or a person of color to diversify the group of current late-night talk show hosts.
Honestly, I wish a female host was coming along, like Amy Poehler or Tina Fey or someone. I'm kind of sick of like all these white guys being hosts.
On-air correspondent Mary Murphy for The Insider says she hoped CBS would have taken that risk.
Yet again, here we have another white male, and I don't think it reflects, you know, our world, our society.
At the same time, Murphy says CBS took a risk by picking a new host outside of the mainstream realm of other late-night hosts, since Colbert is political and appeals mainly to younger audiences.
This moves CBS Late Night not only into the future, but into the future of the younger generation.
Still, because Colbert plays a role on his current show, Murphy says it remains unknown if audiences will like the real Colbert in his role as a late-night host. The answer to this question awaits Colbert's late show takeover in 2015. Sarah Zahedi, Annenberg Radio News.
A team of reporters from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has won this year's Selden Ring, an annual prize awarded by USC's School of Journalism for outstanding journalism with an exceptional civic impact. Their winning report is Deadly Delays. It investigates the consequences of delaying important tests given to newborns for genetic disorders. I caught up with three members of the team during their trip to Los Angeles to collect their award. I'm here today with Marty, George, and Ellen from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
First of all, congratulations on winning the Selden Ring Award. Can you tell us more about Deadly Delays and why you've won this award?
Deadly Delays is a story about delays in the nation's newborn screening program. Every baby gets tested for these genetic disorders shortly after they're born, but we found that hospitals were delaying sending these important tests to state labs, and as a result, babies were being harmed. What's really exciting about this story in general is that hospitals and states throughout the country have fixed the problems, and they're continuing to try to eliminate delays so the babies are safer.
Can you talk us through your reporting process and how you use data to support your story?
So the main idea of the story was to quantify how big the problem of delayed newborn screening samples was throughout the country. How many samples, how many hospitals were late sending these newborn screening samples to state labs? And so I did that by requesting data from every single state with hospital names, and we wanted to make sure to hold hospitals accountable and hold states accountable. And so it was a lot of just negotiating for data, fighting with the states to release the information, you know, that we believe is public record, so parents can see what's actually going on in the hospitals where their babies will be born.
In the era of cutbacks, how do you justify focusing on longer investigative pieces?
We made a plan that we've got to do enterprise investigative reporting. We've got to do stories that can make a difference in our community. So we've had to make tough choices. We just can't do the small daily stories that don't make any difference. And our readers have responded from that. They expect that from us.
Do you think you've inspired other news outlets to take the same approach?
It is interesting. You know, I don't want to sound too full of ourselves, but I have heard over the years other newsrooms say, well, let's do the Milwaukee plan. Let's do the Milwaukee approach. And who would have thought that the city in the upper Midwest, where major news organizations across the country would talk about that? And what they're doing by that is saying the importance of investigative reporting. And I really think in the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of news organizations across the country have decided that that's the way to go. They may have smaller newsrooms, but they can't be everywhere anymore. So they better have focus when they do it.
And why is investigative reporting so important?
At its core, what investigative reporting can do is can help people make their lives better by finding out what's really happening, holding public officials accountable, holding institutions accountable, how their tax dollars are being spent. It's really important.
How do you ensure that your work makes a long-lasting difference?
One thing we do is we look for someone who's doing it better. In this case, with Deadly Delays, Ellen found that in the state of Iowa, that they were going to get their newborn screening tests in a timely manner and have done so. And so we showed by using the Iowa example that it can be done, that there are no excuses. And when you do that, it's really hard for people to run away from the problem like they otherwise would. The other thing we have to do is stick with it and make sure we keep looking at the evidence to make sure that the improvement continues and that the people aren't just saying they're going to do something about it and then don't really fix the problem. And I think with this particular issue, public disclosure, many states are putting the numbers up online so that parents can check the hospitals out. And I think that might be the most important change of all.
Marty Jordan Ellen from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, thanks very much for joining me today on Annenberg Radio News.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. It's National Robotics Week, and today the Viterbi Engineering School at the University of Southern California opened its doors to the community to show what researchers have been working on. Emmanuel Martinez went to check it out.
Robots were strutting their stuff in classrooms at the Ronald Tudor Hall in the engineering school at USC today. Some could fly, a few could move their limbs, and others could talk.
You chose the workout game.
We have different kinds of robots, and our idea is to have all these robots collaborating to achieve tasks that can't be achieved with one single robot.
That's Jörg Mueller. He's a postdoctoral researcher at the Viterbi School of Engineering. He and his fellow researchers mounted a series of cameras and sensors on a drone so it can determine its position within any room.
It has a sonar sensor that can measure the height, and internally it has an orientation sensor that can measure how the robot is tilted to keep it in a horizontal and stable position.
Other robots use sensors to differentiate between people and objects. PR2 is a humanoid because it has eyes, arms, and ears. According to Amin Atrash, a researcher at Viterbi, PR2 sees you as a big blob, then tries to determine whether you have bones or not.
How well does the skeleton fit? If it's good enough, then it says that must be a person. If the skeleton doesn't fit, then it's probably not a person.
The researchers designed PR2 to be used in an everyday environment like a home or office.
When I started robotics 15 years ago, most of the robots were either driving robots like military or aircraft.
But there's still a ways to go, like being able to hold a conversation.
One of the things that I look at is like dialogue management. I can talk to the robot, he can talk back. That's still very like much in its infancy. We're still working on those. Those are much more difficult problems.
Other problems include task management and having robots effectively pick up objects. So Terminator won't be ruling the world anytime soon. Well, at least not until Mueller, Atrash, and other Viterbi researchers figure it out.
Awesome.
Emmanuel Martinez, Annenberg Radio News.
Director Drake Dormus has an unusual approach to making films, giving actors a rough plot outline and filling in dialogue with improv. Grace Lim tells us how that approach pans out in his new movie, Breathe In.
The ancient Greeks had six different names for love. Philia love is a type of love between parents and children. Eros love is for sexual passion and desire. Drake Doremus explores both in his new movie, Breathe In. It's a gorgeous, tight film until the last portion of the story. Dad Keith, played by Guy Pearce, is a part-time cellist and high school music teacher. Mom Megan, played by Amy Ryan, runs an antique store and collects vintage cookie jars. Daughter Lauren, played by Mackenzie Davis, is a star swimmer and high school student. The movie opens with the family posing for the annual portrait out in the yard of their old, yet perfectly renovated New England home. But something in the tilted handheld camera and grayish light hints at melancholy and discontent. The clues are subtle, because everything looks perfect on the surface, but the problems continue to reappear. The women obviously dominate in the home and in the film. It's at this point in the game when darkly beautiful Sophie arrives on scene. Felicity Jones is luminous as the 18-year-old piano prodigy with daddy issues. It's the silent but tightly wound budding relationship between Keith and Sophie that is the center point of the film.
You don't seem as young as you actually are.
One day you'll be free.
The piano plays a key role as a theme in the movie and as a theme in the scoring. When Sophie finally performs a few pieces, something changes in Keith. But it's soon after this point where the film starts to unravel into a cliched, sappy puddle. What started as softly beautiful turns into an annoying tale of deceived wife, bratty daughter, and dissatisfying conclusions. The transition is too drastic and too abrupt. What seems so even-handed and sensitive becomes irrational and hackneyed. Breathe In is delicate and elegant, for the most part. But like this review, the end comes with a bad taste of disappointment. Grace Lim, Annenberg Radio News.
Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
Sonic City! Sonic City!
I said I'm not going back home without coming to the Fashion District. Lots of good deals. Where we live, we just have the department stores, regular prices, so we're out here for bargains.
Oh, we have my best worker right here. He's single as the moment, so ladies, come down to the side of your
I'm just here working, you know, my own business. You know, you gotta do a lot of hand gestures, you gotta scream, or you gotta, you know, have a good presentation, especially a good presentation.
Sonic City!
Now we check in with Ashley Regal to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, thanks, guys. A downtown LA high school is standing up, not speaking out, for one science teacher. Find out why they're taking an oath of silence and making it known. Next, your photos and videos can help fight crime in LA. Hear the sheriff department's plan and how you can be a hero. Finally, a double amputee war veteran biked cross-country to raise money for a cause. We'll share his father's reaction. Tune in to ETVN at 6.
The biggest dust-up in modern music is coming again. The Coachella Music and Arts Festival starts this weekend. Annenberg has got you covered. Graham Clark spoke to Neon Tommy photographer Charlie McGovern about reporting from Earth's biggest music festival.
Are you worried about Coachella being a cesspool of decadent neon consumerism?
I'm fully assuming that. That's exactly what kind of why I'm going.
For the full interview, visit annenbergradio.org and read breaking Coachella coverage at neontommy.com. That's it for this Thursday. We had help today from Annenberg TV News and Denise Guerra. Our production assistant is Lexi McAvinci. Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment, and the newscast producer is Victor Figueroa. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Bryony Ng.